Right now, we bring in David Terachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning and with the Media Beat. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And you are still in the great state of Maine, right, David?
Yeah, I'm glad to be reporting in again, but I'm still not from my base HQ in the media capital of the world, New York City. But yes, for now, at least from that great state of Maine, and glad to be discussing things as every week with the sharp-eyed, sharp-eared Marshall Miles. How are you?
Can't complain. Watching things develop on several different levels and taking a look at the media coverage of it as well. Of course, the Maine feeding frenzy is what's going on with the Mar-a-Lago search, the documents there. The latest thing that has popped up is that the judge appears to going to be allow for a broader dissemination of more information. That was what they were looking for, the FBI.
Sure. Well, the media have had a lot of legal trouble in Trump land to report on this week. Only yesterday, Donald Trump's chief financial officer, Alan Weisenberg, pled guilty as part of a plea deal in the case in which he and Trump's company, the Trump Organization, accused of tax fraud and related matters amounting to grand larceny. And this is the background to the case you were mentioning. These are cases in which, 15 felony counts against Weisenberg, which he pled guilty yesterday, and on which he will give evidence when the company's case is planned to be heard in October. In return for that, he'll serve only 5 months in prison, maybe less, with good behavior, and pay out about $2 million in penalties, unpaid taxes, and the like. But, and this is a big but, Weisselberg will not provide evidence against Trump, the man, only against Trump, the company. I'm going to pick my phrases carefully here from the press. The broader investigations into Mr. Trump's business practices, as some in the press are carefully calling them, will continue at both Manhattan level and the New York State level. And with that FBI into Trump taking papers from the White House to his Mar-a-Lago residence, the word of the week, Marshall, it seems to be, has been unsealing. It's a favorite word for journalists. We, by natural disposition, do not like things that are sealed. It's antithetical to our very being, a lot of us think. And a federal judge, a magistrate covering Southern Florida, Judge Bruce Reinhardt, has recently had to make 3 crucial decisions about this case, the latest one only yesterday as well, an unsealing request this time from media organizations ranging from CNN to the Washington Post, NBC News, and the Scripps media empire. They want to know what lay behind the previously unsealed warrant for the FBI to raid Donald Trump's home. They were in search of official material that he should not have had, quite simply. 3 decisions, one to grant the warrant in the first place, one after the raid to unseal the terms of the warrant, and now unsealing the evidence that lay behind the Department of Justice believing that they had good reason for mounting the raid. This time, interestingly, Trump himself has said, that's what he said on social media, that he's in favor of unsealing the DOJ's reasoning, though equally interestingly, his lawyers are doing nothing to press for the release. And the judge yesterday ended up saying, and this, as you were saying, was a really interesting development. The judge is saying he's inclined to offer the media half a bone, say. Some of the evidence behind his order for the search could be made public, not all of it. Those matters that concern the FBI and the DOJ, especially revealing evidence and sources that might compromise the ongoing investigation, always a concern with law enforcement in cases like this. There can't be many quite like this are weighing on him. And the judge obviously wants to preserve the case's integrity, as he should. But he's, excuse me, he's just as clearly cognizant of the media's claim for justice to be as apparent as it can be. And we should remember, I think, that he's the judge, the very same judge who heard the FBI's application in the first place. He's well aware of their reasons for believing that they have a case against Trump, including suspecting that crimes under the Espionage Act were committed. And this is serious business. But can I just broaden this out a bit? Because it's been an interesting week, even beyond the direct legal arguments about specific issues before the courts. The overall related notions of free speech, our free press, the free social media even, have gained extra prominence over this past week. Freedoms that, let's face it, can involve violent, even fatal actions. First, there was 42-year-old Ricky Schiffer, a military veteran who served in Florida and in the U.S. Navy. He posted on Trump's own social media site, I should maybe call it anti-social media site, Trump's chosen name for it is Truth Social, more like anti-social untruth, others might say, though. And it's on that site that Schiffer called on people to kill federal officers. Then he launched his own assault, unsuccessful, of course, on an FBI field office in Cincinnati. That, as we know, led to a police car chase. In the end, he's being shot dead in an Ohio cornfield. Now, the next day, this last week, another evidently avid follower of extreme social media postings, 24-year-old Hadi Mattar, was arrested for the attempted murder of the author Salman Rushdie. And it's been a full 33 years since the fatwa death sentence was declared against Rushdie by Iran's Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Remember him? But himself now dead. Long ago. Now, the 24-year-old Mattar wasn't even born when the fatwa was issued. He's a California native, the son of Lebanese parents, and later a New Jersey resident, and he appears to have eagerly followed Shiite extremists online, as well as the activities and announcements of Iran's notorious Revolutionary Guards. He presented himself in a New York Post jailhouse interview. Trust the New York Post. They have great contacts in law enforcement generally. And yes, they got a jailhouse interview with Mattar. But he presented himself there as an archetypal digital native of his generation, saying he spent most of the time, let me quote him, using the internet, playing video games, watching Netflix, stuff like that. While he was also affirming his admiration for the late Ayatollah. I think he's a great person, he said about Khomeini. Some things changed, Marshall. The medium of influence may have changed in those 33 years. We're a long age away now from the holy analog, secretly distributed cassette tapes. Remember those? With which Khomeini initially spread his violent fundamentalism. But such extremism still holds, just retains its hold on the impressionable right across our World Wide Web, whether supposedly religious, as in this case, or political. It all makes me think, in a mood of sad irony, I'm afraid, of that slogan that was current at the turn of the century. Let me quote again, this time from a Democratic politician, in fact. The ultimate democratization of our means of communication. That was how the internet was being hailed back in those heady days. not least, as I'm remembering, by the leading Democrat Party strategist, Joe Trippi. I wrote about this week at MediaBeat.us that you were helpfully citing before we started talking. I was noting what a falling off there has been in the role of the Internet. By contrast with those high hopes back in the early 2000s, the net has just turned into a wild west, free-for-all, full of untrammeled, hate-filled incitement, all too familiar to people who study this phenomenon, like Alex Friedland of the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism, to which I turned this week. He says, Friedfeld has said that he had a very particular way of phrasing it. He said, figures online now employ a kind of what he calls a rhetorical two-step, whereby they aim to oppose violence and yet terms, and they issue calls for war, insisting all the while that such calls are metaphoric. There's been nothing metaphoric about what we've seen this past week. That crazed individual who drove his car, this is Richard York III, driving his car into a barricade on Capitol Hill, of course, where else, and got shots and in the end killing himself. So we must wonder what he'd been scrolling through and viewing and listening to before he took his catastrophic, probably almost certainly deranged decision. So what we're seeing, I think, is clusters of cases like Matar and Schiffer and perhaps York as well. The Internet has become something else very different from what was hoped for, and in this case, much reduced. It's now it's dismal to see this. It's become a mere forensic tool for discerning, or trying to discern, way too late, and that's too often true, just what disturbed thinking, if that's what it might be, that might lie behind extreme, even fatal acts. These are difficult subjects, reconciling press freedom, freedom of speech for the public and social media, with the danger of, as I say, horrific, fatal violence.
You know, that I'm glad you pointed this out. For years now, people have been blaming just video games. Our children growing up on video games, becoming adults, and that causing the violent behavior. But the Internet has become a place where people who have deep hate, no matter who it is they hate, the deep hate has an outlet now where people can grow their hate together. And it also has organized websites like Truth Social, and not only Truth Social, but other sites as well, where the few who are deranged and disturbed enough can get together. And the Internet now, unfortunately, empowers these people to go out and do things that probably before the Internet they wouldn't ever do.
Yeah, that's very arguable. What is often said, and certainly was in the days before the Internet, when the notion of free speech had a kind of simpler avenues for expression, at least if there was a safety valve, if people could get off their chests the anger that they felt, then it would operate as a safety valve and could maybe divert people into the expression of their violent feelings without actually taking an act. But what seems to have happened is very much the opposite. We've got a kind of pressure cooker effect, and the herd mentality is encouraged here too, of course, and there is a kind of peculiar safety in the semi anonymity that the internet offers you. We know this is very true in all sorts of walks of life, but being anonymous enables you to be a lot more extreme than you would if you had to put your name and your face and your identity to what it was you were saying in public. And what we're having instead is a ratcheting up of the violence of the language, and as I say, a kind of mealy-mouthedness, or as at least the Anti-Defamation League's researchers are saying, is very much a device available to leaders, and their political leaders most of the time, able to say with one side of their mouth that they're against violence, but with the other side going on to encourage it. And this entire pressure cooker effect takes, in the end, its form of maybe just one, maybe just two, maybe just a few people who will take action, going out there and doing something heinous and fatal often. And, you know, in a way, the internet is enabling the people who arguably have greater political responsibility for leadership are able to wash their hands and say, as has been said many times over, even in the days before the internet, oh, there are always going to be extremists who go off the deep end, but they're nothing to do with us. Well, I'm afraid in the days of the internet, it's all one mixture boiling up in this pressure cooker, if I can strain my metaphor a bit further. And we know that, I say we know, I mean, many studies do suggest that things are definitely getting worse. What one does about it, of course, is a complicated and difficult question. It raises questions of regulation or even censorship, real hot button issue, a whole can of worms that we have no way of, no hope of opening to any in any way that's going to satisfy people who want reasoned argument. It's a really difficult issue to find a way out of that is safe, increases the general safety and security of the population as a whole, while at the same time protecting the rights of people to say what they're entitled to say.
You know, when you look at the internet, a lot of people like to look at networks, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and they point out the wrongdoings of the networks and how the networks seem to pick sides and everything like that. Well, it's the same thing with the internet now, where it's almost like the internet is a huge ocean, and when blood gets in the water, doesn't matter if it's a little blood, sharks converge to find out where that blood comes from. And I'm a big believer in the fact that when you call the internet the Wild West, that's exactly what it is right now. It didn't start slowly. If you go back in time, before there was Donald Trump, there was Sarah Palin. And the way Sarah Palin campaigned for vice president, which was very, very successful in a lot of ways, and it didn't work out in other ways. But then Donald Trump campaigning for president, the way he campaigned and the way he used media didn't help. And, you know, we're in a position now, David, I don't know how we're ever going to get out of this position. I really have no idea.
Yeah, it's difficult. Without wanting to be an empty and wholly negative Cassandra here, a prophet of doom, I'm afraid I'm with you. I don't see an easy way out of it at all. The putting the onus on the media companies that control the internet is one way that's being attempted. But it's such a disparate and difficult area to police. Even with the best will in the world, and there is not the best will in the world, to be frank, amongst the leadership of companies like Facebook, or rather Meta, as they're now known, and the other big shots of the media world, their business model is built upon engagement, and we know that outrage and anger and indeed, you know, horrific threat-making is crucial to that business plan. I mean, we know that those hot-button emotions are what keep people clicking through, and people clicking through is what they need, because the business model is based on being able to advertise to greater and greater pairs of eyes, greater numbers of pairs of eyes. And the whole assumption that this multi-billion enterprise is based upon is getting people stirred up. It's as simple as that, and it's not. Yes, you know, it is, as I keep saying, rather forlornly, I'm afraid. It's a world away from what Tim Berners-Lee was thinking when he came up with the notion of the World Wide Web. It was meant to be a place for sharing ideas, and you know, right, like a wonderful idealization in the electronic form of the old Greek forum, ancient Greek forum, public debate in the public square. It's come a long way downward from that. And again, you know, it's a forlorn expression, but I see no way out of it, no easy way out of it, put it that way.
All right. In the final few minutes, I want to just go to Ukraine and what's going on there. Russia obviously has run into now some serious problems where inside their own country, they now have special units from Ukraine operating along with not only the weapons that the United States and other countries have provided, but now special commandos going in and bringing the war home to Russia. And I think that is something that's being overlooked. That, to me, signals that sooner or later, by bringing that war home to Russia, where it's all sudden a reality, it does set in every day where there's explosions, there's deaths. This will stalemate what's going on even further, and maybe hopefully push Russia and Ukraine to some sort of talks, because this is now something that is not going to be dealt with in months, but years, unless something comes about it and some other country can convene and get these two countries together.
Sure. The war is coming up very soon on its six-month mark. It's quite an extraordinary thought to digest just for a second. But yes, it may be many more months, and I dread to think, but possibly years, before the war ends. All wars end. That's almost inevitably true. The terrible thing is, you know, how long it can take for the hostilities to continue before one or other or both sides get worn down enough to say that the negotiating table is the only place they can go now. The hope is that that will happen sooner rather than later. And sure, the pressure on Russia is, the most obvious thing to say about it is a hell of a lot more than Putin would appear to have ever expected. Russia in its various iterations from Tsarist Russia to the Soviet Union to now has experience of overstretching itself in terms of conducting wars. The Soviet Union got itself bogged down, rather like the United States got bogged down in Vietnam when the Soviet Union was waging war in Afghanistan. That war also came home for them, mainly in the form of young soldiers coming home in body bags. But it made its impact upon the public, however repressive the Soviet regime may have been. And yes, you could be right. The internal pressures on Putin might be rising to the level of him having to make a decision that I'm sure for now he has no intention of making, but may well have to, which is recognize that the war is in the end unsustainable on his side. And those talks, there are now forums established in which at least some agreement can be arranged between the two sides. It's interesting that the combination of the United Nations and one particularly, economically strategically helpful neighbor, Turkey. Have been able to get both sides to agree to one thing, which is, in this case is the export of vital grain supplies to the outside world, coming from the steppes of that part of Eastern Europe. It has long fed the world, and the war has proved to be a terrible interruption to food supplies globally. But that's been altered to some degree by getting both sides to come to an agreement. I mean, not a very convivial agreement, far from it. They wouldn't even sign the same piece of paper, but each has a copy of this agreement, which is for now holding. So it's possible, theoretically at least, for agreements to be made between these two warring parties. It's just a matter of how bitterly the hostilities have to get further entrenched before the decision to actually negotiate comes around.
It's something we'll be talking about and dealing with for quite a while. David, it's always great to speak to you. We'll check in with you again next Friday.
Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find the Media Beat at their website, themediabeat.us, and here at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.